No 50º episódio de Block Talks, a gente conversa com Jeremy Drain, cofundador da plataforma Nifties, que conta pra gente sobre metaversos, NFTs, mídias e videogames, agora e no futuro. Essa entrevista está em inglês. Eu sou Maurício Magaldi e esse é o Block Drops, o primeiro podcast em português sobre blockchain para negócios. As notícias que você ouve aqui não têm qualquer vínculo com o meu trabalho atual, não configuram nenhuma forma de patrocínio, propaganda ou incentivo para o consumo e têm o foco exclusivamente educacional para o mercado.
All right, everybody. I have Jeremy Drain here with me. He's going to tell us who he is and what he does with blockchain. Jeremy, thanks for joining Block Talks. Happy to have you here.
First off, thanks. I appreciate the opportunity. I'm your 50th guest, so that's a good round number. I appreciate the opportunity to be on and talk with you. Who I am and what do I do in blockchain, right? That's our starting point. again, Jeremy Drain. I generally think of myself as a crypto entrepreneur. I've been in the space since 2013. That's when I heard about Bitcoin. And then from there, in 2014 is where the conversation started to change, you know, more around, you know, blockchain from Bitcoin. And the woman that wrote the very first book on blockchain named Melanie Swan, I reached out to her and I did a cold call and I just said, I can't find anything on blockchain. You wrote the only book. Please tell me what this magical technology is. And she was like so gracious and she introduced me to really many of the very first gen people in the space. And so I met a lot of the very original people in the space. And then in 2015, I founded PricewaterhouseCoopers, or PwC's blockchain practice. So I was the first person in, which is an interesting story we can get into. But I did that for like a year and a half. At that time, no one really knew or cared about blockchain. And most of my colleagues at PricewaterhouseCoopers thought that Bitcoin was quote unquote devil money. And so I was sort of the first guy in, and I did that for a little bit. And then I ended up leaving and I helped begin the enterprise version of a company called Libra. It was the first ever blockchain tax startup in the world. Jake Benson had been the original founder. He had founded it as a consumer product. And then I came into the company and basically said, okay, let's make this an enterprise product. And we got a couple original investors and we ended up selling our name to Facebook and we changed our name to Luca. And now Luca is, you know, probably the, one of the largest crypto tax and accounting software companies in the world. There's a couple other ones out there, but Luca's, you know, one of the biggest, if not the biggest. So I did that for like 4 or 5 years. And then during that time, I started to do a lot of different things in the space. I made a lot of different investments. And ultimately, I ended up co-founding Nifties, nifties.com. And Nifties is an NFT marketplace with a strategic partnership with Warner Brothers. And so we ended up doing some NFTs for Space Jam the movie with LeBron James. Then we turned around and did some NFTs, or, you know, we're doing some NFTs for Matrix the movie, the new movie that's coming out. And so I did that for a little bit of time. And then I stepped back and I stepped down. And now really where I am, I guess to take it full circle, is I'm a senior advisor on a handful of very specific projects that are focused around video, that are focused around play-to-earn gaming, that are focused around DAOs, And that are obviously focused around metaverse, which sort of like encapsulates quite a few things. And, you know, so I'm very, very focused on driving the growth of the NFT marketplace with, you know, metaverses and play to earn gaming and DAOs and all of those pieces and parts. And, so that's what I do today. And, you know, I do that under, I have my own, crypto fund. So I run my own fund, which is my own capital, and, make investments. And I act as a senior advisor across the space in terms of a handful of projects that I work on specifically. So I've kind of went from a PwC grunt all the way to this entrepreneur dude that like has a crypto hedge fund and does all these wacky things. And, you know, I did that over 6 or 7 years, and it's been an awesome, you know, period of time.
That is an interesting journey for sure. Now, I really have to pick your brain into, because we happened to speak last week. You were on NYC NFT, and it was a huge buzz on Twitter. I wasn't able to go, but I followed a number of accounts that were there. And now I have to pick your brain on this. What do you look for? You don't have to give me the magic sauce, but what are, say, the top three things when you look into a project and say, I want to be a part of this. I want to be involved into this, because there's a lot of mishmash and, you know, potentially fraud and all that. How do you sort stuff? Is just the people? Is just the tech, a combination of the two? We're in very early stages of many of the things that are happening. So how do you pick and choose for your own development?
Well, I mean, I think first off, it's I only work with people that I know on some level, or somebody that I trust implicitly, trust them implicitly. So I 100% don't even, I don't, I mean, you know, if I don't know you, but we have a share a common friend, and I trust that common friend, then I'll get involved on some level. But I really, it's 100% the people. I mean, for me at least. Number two is like, I only work with people that I like to work with. I know that that's like, you can get to that point in your career, you know, crypto, there's all different types of personalities, and that's what makes it so interesting. But at the end of the day, you know, we've all had those experiences where we've had to work with people that, you know, were very difficult for whatever reason. And so, you know, I just have to, you end up working 12, you know. The question is, you know, how do you work with, you know, only work with people you like? So that's like number two. And then I think number three is I'm very focused on, you know, a very particular part of the ecosystem. And so there's like awesome projects everywhere. And, you know, you just have to say no 99% of the time, because you just can't give them, you know, the focus that you need. So I really look for things that are already part of my core area of focus. And can I do, by working on one thing, do I get like some sort of additional effect or compounding value to it in terms of the other things that I'm working on? So it's really, you know, the people that you're working for, do you like them and do they like you? And is this going to be a fun thing? And then does it turn out to be very, very specific to where I'm currently focused? And so those are kind of just the way that I make my decisions. And then I try not to kill myself, because there's so much in this space. You could end up working, you know, 24/7, 365. So you just sort of have to take it back a little bit.
Blockchain doesn't sleep, right?
No, so man, it's
a never ending thing.
It's insane how much great information is out there. Every day I like want to try to, I could probably read for 8 hours and I wouldn't even like scratch the surface of everything that happened that day. So you just have to be really sort of, you know, particular.
No, for the regular podcast that we do on a weekly basis, started off for the most part with the three top headlines. But there's so much going on that now I have to do the three digest, and then I go through a bunch of other headlines for the people to not miss stuff. But the good thing is that I follow people that are well into this, like yourself and a number of other people that are actively working on this, that if you or someone shares something I know that's valuable, and then I can spend my time on that. So it sort of helps me curate the content. So appreciate that, by the way. Thanks for that. Now, you go through all this process. Is there any particular project that you're currently advising for that you would, you know, think it's like the highlight of what you're currently doing and that you can share, of course? And in that specific place, how did that come about? Was that serendipity or went through all these three stages of selection?
Yeah, so I currently work on three projects concurrently. All three of them actually kind of work together as one, even though they're three different projects. All of them are centered around video-based NFTs. And so one of the projects is sort of the manufacturing of those video NFTs. Another one is dealing with all of the legal and compliance and the regulatory issues associated with those NFTs. And then one is the distribution of those NFTs. And so it sort of is the full life cycle. But really, the thing that sort of sits central to what I currently work on is video NFTs. Now, how I got focused on video NFTs is, you know, what I kind of viewed was happening was that when NFTs came out, they're just images. And, you know, that's cool. There were collectibles. And I mean, that's largely what they are today. But I think really where NFTs will go to is they will become experiences. And experiences are, you know, a combination of different things. They're images, but they're also sounds and they're also movement. And if you look at any social media network in terms of the growth and its development, it always gets to video. And so video is, it's 80% of the internet. It grows at 10% CAGR. So video is going to be, you know, the content that will sit within NFTs, will sit within an NFT container going forward. So I just kind of viewed NFT like V1 of NFTs as being images, and then V2 going forward, it will move to video. And so I started to like just get deep down the rabbit hole of why I thought this was important. And the reality was that streaming services today, like all you can eat streaming services for $19.95 or whatever, that's the current norm. And really, if you look back in terms of like the consumption models for video or whatever, you had like, you know, film, and then you had VCR tapes, and then you had DVDs, and then you had high-res DVDs, and then you had streaming. And what's interesting about streaming is that you don't actually own the media that you consume. And so what ends up happening is you get divorced from, you know, the value of that media and what that means in terms of the creators that create it and the consumers that consume it. And in the streaming model right now, all of the value capture, or a lot of the value capture, is in the distribution channel. So it's in the Hulus and the Netflix and the Amazons. Like they own the world right now. And what I find interesting and where I'm sort of pointing my time is, you know, I think that there's a new, I think what we'll do is, just like we went from DVDs to streaming, I think we'll go from streaming to NFTs. And I think NFTs provide a superior business model for creators and consumers. And I kind of view these distributors of content as being sort of like the current central authority. They sort of sit in between. And so, you know, creators are going to be able to create content. They're going to be able to go out and raise funding directly from the ecosystem to create that content. They can sell it directly to the consumers in the ecosystem. They can generate value on the first and every subsequent sale in terms of royalties. And then the consumers on the other side, they can buy content, they consume it, they can resell it if they don't want it, they can hold on to it if it appreciates in value. And in this way, I think you have a much better sort of way in which media is created and consumed. And so I do believe, like, when somebody says, like, how does Amazon lose? How does Netflix lose? I think it's, you know, they lose to networks of creators and consumers that now have the ability to connect directly. And so I'm super, super focused on this sort of my own sort of operating thesis here and why I focus on video. So I got into the rabbit hole on a project about how are these, you know, video NFTs created at scale at a low price point? How does one actually make sure that copyright and IP and all of those things are protected? And then how does one find a way to distribute this? And then, of course, I ended up working for Nifty's because Nifty's is a distribution channel. I have a position on in Monax, which deals with all of the legal issues. And I'm super, super deep down the rabbit hole of VideoCoin, which is the project that manufactures these video NFTs. So that's kind of how that all happened. And I sort of have taken a life cycle approach. And rather than working at one, I've invested, obviously, in all three. And I sort of sit and I spend my time across each of the three so that I can understand which one needs the most amount of time, effort, and money so that we can move the, you know, the collective ship forward.
Absolutely. It's the promise of blockchain to remove intermediaries. And your whole rationale was, okay, so the distributors, the current distributors are the banks of today in that space. These are the distributing channels of the current assets. Mm-hmm. Now, that's where the money's sitting right now. When we disrupt that function, we then redistribute wealth across the supply chain. In this case, it's video and entertainment and whatnot.
Absolutely.
How do you see this playing out? Because, I don't know, the GAFN or whatever the big techs are, the acronym they're using today, they're not going to sit idle and look that happening, or either the major recording companies or the movie industry. How do you think that this is going to rebalance? Because what you're proposing is a rather radical change in the balance of not one, but many industries. How do you think, or how are you planning to actually help these things rebalance? Because there's going to be pushback for sure.
So a couple different ways to answer the question. So first off, let's like validate that my thesis actually has legs. So in the music industry, for example, musicians get 12% of the revenue. Okay. Consumers don't actually own any of the music that they listen to, right? It's just your Apple subscription or your Spotify subscription, right? So all the value is really accruing to the intermediaries or, you know, central authorities, whatever the words you want to use, but it is really the intermediaries that collect all the value. And so that's like on music. In video, it's a little bit all over the place, but something like maybe the video people might make 35 to 40% of the revenue. Consumers own nothing, and the intermediaries collect all the value. So you have to ask yourself, if you are a creator, whether it's a music or a video creator, you have to ask yourself, do you want to live in a world where you're going to make 12% or 30%, depending on what kind of content you create? Or would you prefer a future where you might collect 70, 80, 90% and you can get subsequent royalties on every secondary sale? Okay. I mean, I'm not the most creative human out there, but I got to tell you, dude, like it's a no-brainer. You talk to any creator out there and they rage on this issue, right? So the people that actually create the content, who create the future, they're going to orient themselves to investing in a model where they can step around those intermediaries and interface directly with their customers. Now, it may take 5 years, 10 years, whatever, but eventually creators who create, they will dictate, I'm going to sell this way and I'm not going to sell this way. And so the reality is they have the power. The other side of the coin is the consumer. You know, to the extent that the consumer is then it purchases something and then it's sitting on their own balance sheet and then it blows up in value and has just like a massive value generating effect, you know, they're going to continually get excited about that kind of a model, which we've seen in collectibles. So I think just generally speaking, both sides of the coin want to connect directly with the other. And there's only so much that those distribution channel in the middle can actually stop that from happening. Now, what do we see them doing? And I'm talking about, for example, Amazon. Amazon very quickly started creating their own custom content because what they realized was if we have a bunch of creators that decide to create on their own and sell directly, and they're going to bypass the Amazon franchise, then we as Amazon need to create our own content. And so what did they do in typical fashion is they vertically integrated, which I would do that too if I was living in Seattle and some executive. But Amazon's just one company. I mean, we live in a world of 7 billion creators. And if those creators want better economics and the consumers want to consume directly and have direct relationships with the creators that they love, you're not going to be able to stop that kind of momentum and that kind of a business model.
I fully appreciate that. You know, being a musician and all, this is certainly speaks to my heart. Again, you've been last week to NYC NFT. We're seeing a number of, now that the reopening is happening all around the world, there's a bunch of new events around not only NFT, but around the blockchain space. We have Lisbon, there's going to be Ethereum, there's Solana Week, Breakthrough Week. How do you see this moving forward in terms of how the, because it's been quite some time that we're at home speaking to the screens in front of us. A number of things expedited because of that, because we're not moving around so we can focus. How do you see this new arrangement in the industry now that the events are coming back? Is this something that is now being sort of compressed and now it's going to expand finally, or we were already expanded? And, you know, how do you see this going forward in terms of how the industry is going to accommodate now that we're reopening? That's one thing. And then I'm going to ask you, how do you see trends going forward after what you've seen in New York?
I think what we learned from the COVID situation is that you can be just as effective in a distributed environment as you can be everybody working for the same company in the same city. And so I think that, you know, a lot of businesses have reevaluated the policies associated with where someone has to live. And it's much more now about how do I find exactly the right person? And if they don't want to live in New York or if they don't want to live in, you know, wherever, then that's going to be okay. But I would also say that with the world opening back up, we also, I think, value personal relationships and interactions, you know, much, much more. And the limited amount of time that you get to spend with people face to face is really important. And you should, you know, pick and choose and invest in people and events that are like really meaningful. And, you know, I can go to a lot of different conferences and I thought that, you know, NFT NYC would be the right one. And we, you know, I invested, you know, my time and met just a bunch of people. But I think at the end of the day, you know, people can work anywhere. That's the underlying story. But the subtext of it is as you do go out into the world, invest your time in people and events that actually are meaningful for you. Don't take it for whatever you think. It's, you know, you do have very, you may have, who knows, we may have another scare and we may all get locked up for another 6 months. So, you know, invest wisely, invest your time wisely. I don't know. It's kind of how I see it.
From everything you saw that week in New York and what you've seen in your own endeavors, I know this is usually a non-answer because it's just too hard to predict too long into the future in this industry. What do you see are, say, one or two key things that you saw that you see that this is moving forward. You mentioned the things that you are currently doing, and I'm pretty sure that those are the things that you trust are the more prominent and hopefully the best result of your own investments. But other than that, what exactly you've seen that in the space that you said, okay, this, if I was not doing this, I would certainly be doing this other two things.
I have my ongoing thesis for video and the reorientation of that value chain, and I'm sort of doing that all the time. But I do have a hobby, and my hobby is play to earn gaming, very much focused on a very specific game called Star Atlas, staratlas.com. I'm one of the largest holders in a very large DAO in that game. And I spend a tremendous amount of time on play to earn gaming because I believe that by the summer of next year or the upcoming summer, play to earn gaming is going to be the apex competitor to minimum wage jobs. And what I mean by that is what you'll find probably in the summer, the economies that underpin many of these games will be able to pay a person more than the minimum wage job in their geography. And so what we'll do is we'll hit sort of like what happened in Philippines with Axie, where I think what now 1 out of 10 adults plays Axie for a living in the Philippines. I mean, that's just such a mind-blowing statistics. People don't even think that it's real. Google play to earn gaming Philippines, and it's all out there. But this is the issue. So I think as of next year, the way in which we organize ourselves to do minimum wage jobs across the entire world is going to be, you know, is going to be challenged. And you usually think like, oh, you know, you'll get some kid or they'll do this for, you know, minimum wage or whatever. Like, why? I mean, you have unemployed people, underemployed people, unhappily employed people, you know, people that are just looking for a side hustle. I mean, these people are going to be able to make $20, $30, $40, $50 an hour playing a video game. And what is that really going to do to the on-the-ground businesses that heretofore, you know, relied on minimum wage workers to execute those jobs? I think we're gonna see such a significant change in the way in which we work, how you get employees, and all of the sort of the follow-on effects. I just don't think people have really gotten their mind around to it. You know, I personally have invested in a lot of like metaverse and play-to-earn games to try to sort of get in front of, you know, these sort of mega trends. But I mean, shit, who's going to run the Wendy's and McDonald's drive-through window at $12 an hour when they can sit in their pajamas playing Star Atlas and make $30? And they can learn a little bit about financial, you know, and coding and everything else that's utterly relevant while they're playing those games. I spend a lot of time thinking about that issue. And I think the world is going to be utterly unprepared and shocked for the decisions that individuals will make and, you know, what that means to the companies that need those workers.
That is a very interesting take. And one of the things that I come to appreciate in Play to Earn is the ability to also branch out of the game. So you mentioned Star Atlas. I had Michael Wagner here a couple weeks ago, and the movement of, okay, so this is an in-game asset that you can use in the real life world, be it for cash out or to stake it on a DeFi protocol that you can be reimbursed for, or is this just to vote on how stuff is going to happen with the overarching organization of the game itself. So this is so many folds embedded into one traceable asset that I agree with you. I don't think we even started grasping the potential consequences of this in the real world and real life of people. So coming from an emerging market like Brazil, it is one of our concerns that, okay, so this sort of digital space, how this becomes more democratic? How do I bring, because we have a bunch of unbanked citizens and we have, of course, a number of Brazilians under the poverty line. So how do we help bridge those gaps with these marvelous thing that we're currently building all over the world? So this is certainly one aspect to be considered.
Yeah, Brazil is, and I went to Brazil. I was down in Brazil for grad school. I love that. Love that country. Some of the best times of my life. I mean, Brazil is like a perfect example. I'm not sure what the minimum wage is across the country, and I'm sure it's maybe, I don't know what it is. But what I can tell you is that a game like Star Atlas, the value proposition of playing Star Atlas is we're going to teach you about finance. We're going to teach you about blockchain. We're going to teach you about how to make money, what is yield, what assets to buy. We're going to teach you a little bit about technology and coding in a way that's in a game, which, you know, people are able to consume learning when you cloak it with a game in a much better way. And so you get all of these benefits coupled with the fact that you're going to make some cash. And then you look at that and you say, well, how does that stack up against, you know, working at a grocery store or working at a car wash or, you know, whatever the myriad of these other the jobs are. And, you know, it's going to be very difficult for those types of jobs to stack up and, you know, in terms of one to one. And so what you'll see is a lot of individuals that will make, you know, the right decision. They'll make a decision. And then of course, what are people going to do? What will society do to respond to the fact that they can't get anybody to work at a job for less than, you know, $20 an hour? A lot of jobs, you don't need done for $20 an hour. And so, you know, I personally have made some investments in automation technology companies. I think we're going to see mass automation on a scale that like we've never even considered, just because I don't think you might have one person that runs a McDonald's and everything else is a robot. And the reality is that may be the only way to go. And so I really think that the summer of next year, in my mind, is where we see the turning point for the games being out that will be intellectually stimulating enough that people will want to invest the time to learn how to play them. And then those economies will just compound faster than I think anybody can realize until we really have a very interesting, set of situations on our hand around, you know, getting people to work at, you know, real jobs for a little money.
I like this, but I wanted to sort of have your thoughts on what would have to be overcome to get to that point, because we know that there's like huge socioeconomic gap in most of these countries. There's digital illiteracy, so people don't really understand digital. They barely understand reading and writing, so this is another challenge. And of course, the play-to-earn model still requires, if you pick, for instance, Axie Infinity, it's right now it's expensive for someone to onboard. So what would be, say, the collection of things that need to be put in place for those barriers of entry to be lowered, and then we have this massive adoption that you foresee in the summer next year?
Well, I mean, I think most people can get access to internet these days. There's enough of these games now that are coming out that have very low price points that don't require scholarships on the front end. And then keep in mind that, you know, as people buy into these games, you know, they're essentially buying into assets that have not appreciated yet. And so their personal balance sheets will improve considerably as those games grow, which means they can then reinvest in other things, you know, better computers and whatnot. So I haven't really broken it down in terms of like what are all the pieces and parts and you know, what's the, you know, rate of improvement across each of them in order to get to this output. But, you know, generally speaking, just internet access is key. And then, you know, having a cell phone, which almost most humans on earth have them, you know, those are the only two things you need. And there's enough proliferation of games that are coming out that don't require high scholarship or buy-ins for people to play that, And that's why I said it was kind of more around the summer of next year. You know, right now there's only three or four of these games. By the summer of next year, there's going to be 30 to 50 to 100 of these games. And so there's just going to be a whole set of games where the buy-in is, you know, the buy-ins have price points all over the map that anyone can afford. So I don't think, I think the play to earn ecosystem and marketplace is going to be diverse enough with enough games that are interesting enough, that are basic enough, even if you don't even know how to spell play to earn, it doesn't even matter. It's all intuitive. It's all graphics. And there'll be enough of these games out there that they'll be able to onboard almost anyone from, you know, people that have, you know, very limited financial literacy to, you know, some of the super brains of the world and everything in between. And really, if we look at what happened in the Philippines, and if we look at Axie Infinity, and we look at the uptake and the rate of growth of that ecosystem and how it onboarded such a diverse population of people, you know, you take that and multiply that by 30 to 100 games across the globe. I think you just, I don't think anybody's really prepared for that kind of a future.
Absolutely. And especially that there's some mechanisms that are being put in place, like yield guild games and all the micro revenue streams that can help you sort of propel yourself to higher ranks and then earn more. And that I think also retrofeeds into the whole ecosystem, and people will take advantage of that because that's, you know, exactly what they're designed for. And one of the matters that I think all of this will solve, and we haven't yet gotten to that point, but we will, is the universal basic income, and all those micro revenues will add up to something that is sustainable. And as you say, now I don't need to choose an underpaid or a borderline ludicrous type of work, like cleaning like stuff that I don't want to, because I can just be at home and learn more and play and get to earn my own income.
Yeah, it's interesting. I hadn't thought about it, but the reality is because these are games, and in many cases, the games, you know, adopt the policies of the players. If in fact the players decide for a specific game that if you execute the following series of tasks, you're guaranteed to make the following amount of value, you could end up with universal, you know, income for anybody that plays a very specific game. And so then in that way, you're not relying on governments to step forward and fill that hole. It could turn out that the games will basically do that for the governments, for the players that are willing to play. And we'll see some of that. I mean, we've already seen some of it a little bit, but I think I hadn't considered it quite at the scale. But yet, universal basic income can essentially be achieved, you know, within these games, if you have enough of these games that actually apply those types of policies. So that's a cool sort of thought process. I hadn't considered it.
I know we have limited time, and I don't want to, you know, take, I could take more of your time if you let me, but I appreciate the whole thing. But I need to ask you something before we break, which is your thoughts on Mark Zuckerberg's new company or new name for the company, Meta. What do you think that this is going to do with stuff that we've been working on previously, and now the guy just changes the name and everything sort of seems to start happening? What are your thoughts on the change of the name and whether you think this is going to have any major impacts into everything that we are currently doing in the space?
Well, I mean, it will absolutely have massive impacts. I mean, just the sheer number of humans that use the service as it is today. It's such a massive, you know, onboarding mechanism for, you know, for society. You know, in terms of Facebook going into metaverse, I mean, look, they're a private company. Well, they're a public company, but, you know, they're a company, and, you know, Mark as the leader of that company can choose to do whatever he wants. The great thing about crypto that I always find is, like, people don't tell you what to do. You know, you just do what you get to choose. And so the fact that he's chosen to do that, I think, is, like, well within his rights. And I certainly hope, you know, there's some things that a lot of folks don't like about Facebook. I hope that, you know, by hitting sort of the reset button and reframing the company as a metaverse company, that they'll sort of take a different approach to some of the issues around privacy and so forth. But like anything, we're all so at the very beginning of this, we're all going to learn as we go. They will as well, and they'll stumble and make mistakes. But I hope at the, you know, on balance, you know, 5 years into the future, that this will be have made a really positive step for, you know, society and for the customers and so forth. I personally am not a very big user of their products and services. I just, you know, I'm a crypto dude, so I like Signal and I like Telegram, and I, you know, I keep a lower profile on Facebook and so forth. But I think at the end of the day, I mean, look, the news went out and all metaverse, everything went up, you know, 50%. Like, everybody knows that this is a huge validation. It's a recognition that this is the path forward. And I think that's awesome for us as a crypto and blockchain ecosystem. And, you know, I hope they do awesome things. And, you know, I have nothing but positivity going forward. They're like, why the hell do you think, would you think negative things? Like, nah, man, I think we all have a great future. And I think they're going to be a big part of it. And I think if we like accept them in and help them see the right ways to do things, the things that have made our ecosystem successful, they'll take on some of those attributes and they'll hopefully, you know, do things the way that, you know, we would hope they would. So I think it's an all in all, I think it's very positive. I mean, those guys are geniuses. They're going to kick some ass. And like, why be on the wrong side of that? And so we'll have to wait and see. But it's great for this. It's great for the ecosystem, in my opinion.
Awesome. Yeah. Hopefully the light bulb went on and they said, okay, so if this is the path back to some normalcy, if we give these people their privacy back. So hopefully that will come into play for sure.
Yeah, I mean, you're not going to, I mean, the metaverse, this whole thing is all about self-sovereignty and privacy and, you know, reducing middlemen and, you know, eliminating rents and all of those things. I'd find it really difficult for them to be highly, highly successful in like as a metaverse company, which really means a crypto company, a blockchain company, an NFT company, like all of those things are wrapped up into this thought of what metaverse is. I find it very difficult for them to be successful if they don't understand the underlying sort of ethos of the ecosystem and adopt it on their own. And otherwise, they'll be, you know, another great company, you know, that, you know, lost. And we'll, you know, there's lots of great companies that if we look back over time, they had unbelievable franchises and they screwed it up. And if they don't get this right, I imagine that that's going to be the case for them too.
Absolutely. Awesome. Thanks for that thought. So Jeremy, as we wrap this up, feel free to sort of give out your parting words to the audience. I really appreciate you taking the time. It was super insightful for me and I hope for the audience as well. You know, it's been a privilege to host you as the 50th guest here at Block Talk. So take it away.
Yeah. Let me see. I think the last parting thought I will throw out to people is something that I'm just starting to work on, but I think is really important. And in NFT land, we conflate this idea of possession with ownership. And I bring this up because in the last 3 or 4 weeks, there has just been an unbelievable amount of theft in terms of NFTs. And I think it's hurt our ecosystem because really what it does is it demonstrates to people on the outside looking in that if you lose your keys or if somebody steals your NFTs, that, you know, and they possess those private keys, then they own those NFTs. And there's this limitation in terms of what that means. And again, it's conflating this idea of if I possess the keys, then I own the property. And the reason that I bring this up is there's, I mean, just think about it with your own car keys. Just because you lend your car keys to somebody else or you lay them down and somebody picks them up, that doesn't mean they own your car, right? And so really where I'm sort of like, where I've started to focus down going forward is trying to figure out a world where we can onboard millions of humans to be a part of the ecosystem, which means own NFTs, but also deal with this idea that if they lose their keys or have their keys stolen, that there's some sort of recourse and trying to figure this out. And so I think, you know, for people that I work with or people that follow me, this is the one thing that I think that the ecosystem has to get right. And it's not something that anybody is focused on right now. And so, that's where I'm going to focus my time probably for the next, you know, 6 to 12 months is dealing with this very particular issue. And, for those folks out there that have had, you know, bad experiences, lost their keys or had their NFTs stolen, I am the one human on earth that is very, very focused on solving that problem. Because I think if we can solve that problem, you know, then we will see a lot more, you know, normies join the space. And so I would just say to your listeners, if anybody's been interested in, you know, legal issues and those types of things, you know, just ping me on LinkedIn or Telegram or Twitter or whatever. I'd love to have those conversations because I'm investing time, effort, and money to try to solve that particular issue.
Thank you. No, absolutely. I think that's part of what I'm calling the UX unlock in crypto. If we solve that UX, we'll have massive onboard from the non-initiated because right now it's just too scary to manage that on your own. As you said, there's no recourse. So it's already hard enough to explain blockchain to people. Explaining that they don't own what they had bought, it's even harder. So yeah, let's focus on that. I appreciate your taking the time to focus on that because that's a critical part of the experience for sure. So Jeremy, again, thank you so much. Oh, by the way, if people want to reach out to you, you said Telegram, LinkedIn, Twitter.
Yeah, I'm Jeremy Drain, so I'm on LinkedIn. Anybody can reach out to me on LinkedIn. I'm on Twitter, at Jeremy Drain. And I'm on Telegram at Jeremy Drain. So, you know, feel free to reach out and I'd love to chat with any of your listeners. I totally appreciate the opportunity to chat with you. It was great. Thank you. That's, you know, I don't do a whole lot of this, to be quite honest. So I hope I didn't embarrass myself.
Oh, it's great. It's been great. And I appreciate you taking the time. I know this is not an easy schedule, but thanks. And hopefully we'll meet again in the future when, you know, maybe next summer when 100 games are out, then we can just revisit this.
Oh man, you please have me whenever you can't get a sandwich or something because no one's working at the stores. You can be like, I knew this was going to happen. We could have gotten in front of it.
Let's all learn how to cook our own sandwiches. But awesome. Thanks, man. Take care.
Take care.
Você pode ouvir o Block Drops Podcast nas plataformas Anchor FM, Spotify, Google Podcast, Apple Podcasts, Numis e iColab. Entre em contato conosco através do Instagram, Block Drops Podcast, no Twitter, Block Drops Pod e por e-mail, blockdropspodcast@gmail.com. E um salve para o Jeremy Drain, que compartilhou conosco todos esses insights super incríveis, e também a todos os outros 49 convidados dos Block Talks que nos trouxeram até aqui, com muito insight, muita ideia boa e um privilégio danado de falar comigo e com vocês. A gente fica por aqui, até a próxima, tchau!